We're actually going to read in the New Testament passage from Mark dealing with the two trials. It's the time really as we kind of combine where we're in Passover week, where it goes from the Last Supper, the last Passover, to being taken through the night through two trials before the Sanhedrin and then before Pilate and then off to the crucifixion as we are on Good Friday on the Christian calendar. It says, then they took Jesus to the high priest and the chief priest. The elders and the teachers of the law came together. Peter followed him at a distance, right into the courtyard of the high priest. There he sat with the guards and warmed himself with a fire. The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death. But they did not find any. Many testified falsely against him, but their statements did not agree. Then the high priest stood up before them and asked Jesus, are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you? But Jesus remained silent and gave no answer. Again, the high priest asked him, are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One? I am, said Jesus. And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven. And the high priest tore his clothes. Why do we need any more witnesses, he asked. You've heard the blasphemy. What do you think? And they all condemned him as worthy of death. Then some began to spit at him. They blindfolded him. They struck him with their fists. And they said, prophesy. And the guards took him and beat him. While Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came by. When she saw Peter warming himself, she looked closely at him. You also were with that Nazarene Jesus, she said. But he denied it. I don't know or understand what you're talking about, he said. And went out into the entryway. When the servant girl saw him there, she said again to those standing around him, this fellow's one of them. And again, he denied it. After a little while, those standing near said to Peter, surely you are one of them. You are Galilean. And he began to call down curses on himself, and he swore to them, I don't know this man you're talking about. And immediately the rooster crowed the second time. Then Peter remembered the word Jesus had spoken to him, before the rooster crows twice, you will disown me three times. And he broke down and wept. Very early in the morning, the chief priests with the elders and the teachers of the law and the whole Sanhedrin reached a decision. They bound Jesus, led him away, and handed him over to Pilate. Are you the king of the Jews? Asked Pilate. Yes, it is as you say, Jesus replied. The chief priests accused him of many things. So again, Pilate asked him, aren't you going to answer? See how many things they're accusing you of. But Jesus still made no reply. Pilate was amazed. Now it was the custom at the feast to release a prisoner whom the people requested. A man called Barabbas was in prison with the insurrectionists who had committed murder in the uprising. The crowd came up and asked Pilate to do for them what he usually did. Do you want me to release to you the king of the Jews? Asked Pilate, knowing it was out of envy that the chief priests had handed Jesus over to him. But the chief priests stirred up the crowd and had Pilate release Barabbas instead. What shall I do then with the one you call King of the Jews? Pilate asked them. Crucify him, they shouted. Why? What crime has he committed? Asked Pilate. But they shouted all the louder, crucify him. Wanting to satisfy the crowd, Pilate released Barabbas to them. He had Jesus flogged and handed him over to be crucified. Yeah, I remember I think it was a cop show when I was growing up, and there was a scene where there was these corrupt policemen, and there were actually some people were investigating the corrupt police, who was like a traffic policeman, and so the traffic policeman pulls over actually the investigator, but it's all kind of a setup. He wants to be pulled over. Now, what's ironic about the situation is the policeman thinks he's in control, thinks he's the one doing the interrogating, give me your license. He's the decision maker as to whether you're going to ticket or not. He's the judge. He's hearing it, and he's deciding what to do, but what's the great irony? Actually, the one who's really on trial is the policeman. And the one who's being investigated is the policeman. And I think in one of these situations where Yeshua's on trial, it's much the same way. Who's really on trial here? Today we're going to take a look at these passages, at these two trials, and see what's there, and then ask a great question, what's the big point? Because it's interesting, we're looking at Mark here. Mark's actually the shortest account. You know, some have even more trials before Annas and before, you know, Herod, but he's the shortest one. But I think he makes his point, what he's trying to do with it. We're going to look at that. Firstly, what's there? What's his point? And lastly, what does it matter to us? What's the point to us? Okay, first, what's happening there? Well, off the bat, we see him. It says this is just after he was arrested, right? We have the Last Supper. He goes into the garden. He prays. And then Judas, you know, Judas brings up the guards and they arrest him in the garden. And this is the next thing that happens. They take him to the high priest, the chief priest, the elders, teachers of the law. By the way, whenever you see those chief priest, elders, teachers of the law, when you see that together, that means Sanhedrin. All right, those are the three groups which make up the Sanhedrin. It's the Sanhedrin. It's the chief priest, and that's the same word, by the way, high priest and chief priest. The translators just separate it because it's kind of confusing why it says the high priest, high priests. But the idea is the high priest is pretty much a bot position at this point, even though we know it's the sons of Aaron and stuff. By this point, it's thoroughly corrupt. Actually, you don't know how long the high priest held the position at this point, Caiaphas? Held it for 20 years. And his father-in-law basically held it before with a little break, Annas. So they held it from pretty much 8 AD to 37 AD. You know, so it's just, there was a power position. There was a lot of wealth. A lot of the priesthood was about making a lot of money. You know, these people were very wealthy, rich. They were, the Romans were paid off to get them there. They extorted from the people. Remember, this was actually, and Passover was a big money time, right? People from all the world coming. They're offering all the, they're having to buy sacrifices from them. The temple's full of money, all the money changing and stuff. This was a huge operation. And they were making lots of money. The elders were basically the big wealthy landowners around Jerusalem. It's funny, you don't actually see chief priests and elders, even not that much teach the law. You never see them almost anywhere else in the Gospels where it's happening in the Galilee, because they're not up there. Everyone's around the power base in Jerusalem. Even the teachers of the law, you'll see sometimes, because some of the Pharisees were involved with them a little bit, and you'll see them often be sent from Jerusalem. But Jerusalem's the power base. Most of the other ones you'll see, like Pharisees, are the folks way up in the thing. It's just kind of interesting to see that. And you see the whole chief priest and the whole Sanhedrin. So they're the ones who are meeting. Sanhedrin being the ruling council of Israel, at least 70, you know, of the great elders. But there had to be like a quorum. And even though it says the whole, it probably just means there was enough to make a judgment. But it's happening in the middle of the night, so this is kind of a mock. And it's happening in the courtyard of the high priest. It normally happens in the marketplace, public. Here it's being held like in the middle of the night. You know, after the Passover, it's happening. This is the trial in the middle of the night. And you can see they're, if you hit the next, they're looking for evidence against Jesus so they can put him to death. Oh, there's no yellow on that one, huh? Okay. So they're looking evidence to put him to death, it says already. So it's kind of a, not a real trial in some ways, right? You know, they're trying to get him. And you can see that actually they've done this a whole bunch. If you hit it again, Robert. This is earlier. The chief priest, teacher of the law, heard this, began looking for a way to kill him. This is after he turned over the tables in the temple. This is all happening in that final week. And the whole crowd was amazed at his teaching. Then later, the Passover, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, only 2 days away, and the chief priest, teacher of the law, were looking for some sly way to arrest him and kill him. So they're really ticked. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of it's just a simple power thing. This is their power base. This is their money source. This is the huge week. Everyone's coming. And he's in there throwing over the money to, you know, it's like, who is this guy? The crowds are going after him. And I think it's very simple. They're saying, we got to take this guy out. As long as you get more, I think that's really what's happening here. It's basically a power play. And so, go ahead. So it says they're looking for evidence. Now, the interesting thing is they're still trying to run their evidentiary process. So it's kind of like Congress, you know, even though they're corrupt, they have still have a system they have to go through. You know, so maybe they're not, you don't think they're corrupt. Okay. But you see they're covering a system. And it's interesting, in the Sanhedrin, especially for something like this, like to put someone to death, highest level of evidence was needed. Two or three witnesses can't have absolutely corroborating evidence. It's funny, some people talk today about the death penalty, to have it or not. You know, I think it would change a lot if the death penalty had the same sort of level of evidence needed. Two or three eyewitnesses, no differences in the testimony whatsoever would be the only thing accepted. Any differences at all, you chuck it out. So basically what's happening here is they're chucking out things. Many testified against the misstatements and agree. They're just chucking them out left and right. They actually have no way. He's not making any response back, right? He's saying nothing. So they have actually no way to actually convict him. So finally, the high priest takes PowerPoint. And the high priest finally stands up and says, listen, are you going to answer? What is this testimony the men are bringing against you? But he remains silent. He gives no answer. So eventually he says, he asks him, it's kind of like the magic question, right? He's totally silent. And he finally says, are you the Messiah, Son of the Blessed One? It's like the magic question here. And finally, now he speaks. Now it's kind of interesting there too. You notice the phrase too? You find it surprising the high priest used the term. How many times do you hear people say, like, Son of God? What a weird thing. It's not a Jewish thing to say. It's like, it's a phrase here, Son of the Blessed One, right? You know, that's the high priest using it. It was a messianic title. You know, it's a kingly title. Son of God. And blessed one, by the way, that's just one of these, use a fancy word, circumlocutions. You know, Jewish people don't like to say the name of the Lord, right, since before that time. And so, say, Hashem. Back then, they'd say, like, the blessed. They would say the name back then, but they'd say the blessed. Actually, the mighty one, it's actually the right hand of the power is what it says. It's another one of these things. Right hand of power, the glory, the word. They were all things you'd say rather than saying the name of God. So he's saying the son of the blessed one. Now, what's interesting, he says, I am, which could be nothing. It's common language, but it also happens to be the name of God. Just kind of, you know, I kind of look at it, that's an interesting contrast. You know, it says the blessed, the power. Then he says, are you the son of the man? He goes, I am. And then he says, and you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One coming on the clouds of heaven. Combines two messianic prophecies. At the right hand, you know, Lord said to my Lord, you'll sit at my right hand. Psalm 110 and Daniel 7, the throne room. It'll be coming on the clouds of heaven. Which is interesting that he takes the throne room judgment messianic prophecy, right? Because that's showing that he's going to be judge over the world. So here he's the one on trial and makes a prophecy. Says basically, and I'm going to judge you. And that's probably one of the reasons they're not so thrilled about this thing. And I think there's this thing, element of deity in there coming from heaven. They're expecting this military guy, you know, who's going to take out the Romans. And he says basically, you know, I'm the Son of Man coming from the clouds of heaven. He's sitting at the right hand, all authority of God. It's like, wow. And so then the next line comes, and the high priest goes, you know, next. He tears his clothes. What need do we have more witnesses? This is blasphemy. You know, and blasphemy could be in anything that, it's not just saying you're God. It's, back then, blasphemy could be a lot of things. Anything that would really do something to God, say something about him, you know, is good enough for blasphemy. And they condemn him, and then some began to spit him. They blindfold him. They struck him with their fists, prophesy. The guards took him and beat him. And even Matthew adds, they say prophesy, you know, they blindfold him. They say, tell us who hit you. And that's a play, actually, I guess, on a midrash from Isaiah 11. You know, one of the things it talks about the Messiah, it says where he'll not judge by what he sees with his eyes or decide by what he hears with his ears. So the thing was the Messiah would be able to know, so they blindfold him and say, who hit you? Who hit you? Prophesy. You know, it's a mocking thing. Are you really the Messiah? So this trial is happening in the middle of the night, and then you see very early in the morning, the chief priests with the elders, teachers of the law, the whole Sanhedrin, there's that little group of men, they reach a decision. They bound Jesus, lead him away to hand over to Pilate. Now, it's interesting. Mark never actually tells you who Pilate is. It's presumed you know who Pilate is. You know, Pontius Pilate, governor of Judea. Now, it's just an interesting thing. Prior to 1961, one of the arguments that made the... Mike talked earlier about the whole story being fictional, different things. People say New Testament's fictional. They go, how can you even believe these New Testament accounts? There's no evidence that Pilate ever existed. Such a key figure in all four Gospels. It's in the Apostles' Creed, right? Suffered under Pontius Pilate. Actually, the reason why people don't say the suffered in Pontius Pilate's even in the Apostles' Creed is to stick it in history, to root the entire thing out of faith in an historical place and event, which I think is actually really clever of the early church to stick it. You know, it's not just some obscure belief out there. It's in history. But they would say, Pilate, we have no evidence Pilate ever existed. Well, then 1961 happens in Caesarea. They find a thing, and it says, you know, Pontius Pilate, you know, governor of Judea. It's like, ah, crud. Okay, the guy's going on to the next thing. It's like the whole series of biblical criticisms like that, going, we never have any reason to believe that. And then they find something, go, crud. Like, you know, the great one, the evidence they give, they don't believe they ever wandered in the wilderness. I mean, talk about the idiocy of some of these higher critics. I mean, this has nothing to do with the sermon. But they would say, you know, we find no evidence at all throughout the Sinai Desert of any of the Israelites ever being there for 40 years of wandering. There's no archaeological evidence of it. I mean, they wandered, you know. You can't, you know, it's just like, you idiot. They didn't build cities, okay? That's the idea of the narrative. And they go, oh, we didn't find any cities. Right, you know? It's just one of the, you know, this is honestly, this is evidence kind of presented. You know, they were like, they were nomadic. They're supposed to leave no evidence. It's really just, it's incredible, some of these guys. You always think twice before when people have the criticisms. You look at them, because a lot of times their absence of evidence is no evidence at all. Sorry. You can't prove a negative, right? Everyone knows that, right? It's like people say, you know, we prove there's no... you can't prove... Like, say with black beetles, you can't prove there's no white beetles. All you can say, we haven't found one yet. And all you have to do is find one white beetle to say white, you know. There are, you know, it's the idea of how do you make a proof. And often I say, well, you can't... People, never mind. Anyway, he's with Pilate. He exists. He can't prove it. Doesn't exist because Pilate doesn't exist. Takes one thing to show you, oh, shoot, Pilate exists. Boom, out goes the theory. Anyway, so he goes to Pilate. Are you the king of the Jews? Which is interesting. What's the thing they lodge against him was the idea of being a Messiah and blasphemy. And I don't think that carried a whole lot of weight. By the way, Sanhedrin, Rome gave Sanhedrin all kinds of opportunity to judge themselves and to govern, but Rome kept the sword. They would not give anyone they ruled over, they could not put him to death, so they had to bring him over to Pilate. And blasphemy pretty much was never going to get a charge which Rome is going to care about or to crucify him for. But insurrectionist, leading a rebellion, saying there's another king instead of Caesar, that's a good one. That you'd be put to death pretty quick. You know, that's what the Romans looked for. All right? Someone doing that, bam, you're dead. And actually, we're going to put you on a crucifix. Because we want everyone to see this is what happens when people try to counter Rome power. They want to put them in big public places so you'll know it. And everyone will see it, no doubt. And say, are you the king of the Jews? Now, that's actually a real big translation leap. Yes, it is, as you say. You know what the Greek simply says? You say. That's all it says. And some translators decide what to do with it. Some translations make it just because, are you the king of the Jews? And just says, you say that I am. Yeah, that's all it says. You can tell the NIV they decide to say that that's an affirmation. I don't know myself. And then the chief priests, they're accusing him of all these kind of things. And again, Jesus makes no reply, and Pilate's amazed. You may know from the other gospel accounts like John and stuff, it really goes into this whole thing with Pilate. And Pilate's totally spooked by Jesus. You know, his wife has dreams about him and doesn't want anything to do with him. Pilate's trying to get out of it. And again, Mark doesn't go into great detail on that because I don't think it's his point. But if you hit a little bit more, he makes no reply. And then he's trying to get him released, basically. And he's hoping that... And so it's custom of the feast, and they release a prisoner. And he's trying to get rid of Jesus. And they mentioned Barabbas, who was in prison with the insurrection. And it mentions specifically about Barabbas that he committed murder, which is interesting. You're talking about, like, you know, that's the Ten Commandment, right? He got false testimony here. He got murder. And remember, and what's going to happen is he's going to be released, and the innocent one is murdered. I mean, you're talking about the contrast which the writer is trying to grasp. And even the name Barabbas, right? Any guess on what that means? Actually, you guys can all figure out what that name means. Yeah, Bar, like Bar Mitzvah. Son, Abbas, like Mahmoud Abbas, Abba. Right, son of the father, which evidently was I think was like a slang for bastard. Sorry, but I think it's what it meant. Your son left, I'm sorry about that. It's bad language. It's scripture is not always clean, you know. You know, but I mean, I think it's part of the thing. It's like, ugh, this guy is not a good guy, not a nice guy. Anyway, and when we released to him, they say we don't want it. And eventually, now what's interesting is chief priests stir up the crowd and to release him instead. Hit it again. What shall I do with him? Crucify him? What crimes he committed? And eventually, Pilate just goes, fine. You guys say so, even though he's the one in power. Okay, and I mean, the indifference. All right, well, I got nothing with him, but yeah, flog him, have him crucified. You guys, that's what you want. I mean, it's in the horror. All right, so that's what happened. So what's the main point? What's he getting at from this? Well, I think what he's really trying to get at this thing is the idea that sort of everyone has rejected him. He stood before the courts of Israel. Here you got the chief priests, the elders, he's gone to Jerusalem, he's gone to the center of it. And what's the only question he answers? Are you the Messiah? I am. You know, everywhere else it's just like, you know, he's always kind of like avoiding it or changing names, or he's using all these ways to reveal it. Now he comes to the final thing, and he's unequivocal, he's before the ones in authority, he's before the leadership, he's before everything, and says, this is who I am. And people say he never claimed to be a Messiah. It's like, what are you reading, you know? Boom. Claims it right there, right in front. That's the only question he'll answer. And they reject him. Everybody. Elder, chief priests, the law reject him. And I think the main point of now going before Pilate, what you basically have is the Jews rejecting him, and Pilate represents the world. He represents the Gentiles and the nations. And you can actually see this earlier, if you hit that next one. you know, when Yeshua said he's going up to Jerusalem, he says, we're going up to Jerusalem. The Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests, the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles. It's like being, you know, so Pilate's essentially representing this new handover to the Gentiles. And the Gentiles, they'll mock him, spit on him, flog him, and kill him. And 3 days later, he'll rise. So it's sort of like Jews, you know, to the Jew first, then to the Gentile. It's always he comes to that thing, and then it comes to the world. And basically, what's the main point? All have rejected him. And lest you think for a moment, too, is that you get caught up in the argument of the, you know, who killed Jesus? Was it the Jews? Was it the Gentiles? You're missing the whole thing. You know, the key thing is that, you know, Jesus said, listen, no one takes my life. I lay it down. And that's a huge thing. Do you see the idea of submission coming in both these things? You know, when he's saying, that's the main point with him saying, I'm being silent. You know, he's not, all the accusers are coming and he's not fighting it. He's before Pilate. He's not trying to defend himself. He is submitting himself to this. And it's just like Jonathan read of Isaiah 53. You know, he was oppressed and afflicted. Yeah, he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter. As a sheep before his shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. He submitted to this. No one took him. No one killed him. And even more than that, as Isaiah 53 goes on, I mean, it was the Lord's will to crush him. This was God's doing. No one took his life. He laid it down and was the Lord who wanted to crush him. Now, this is some of the mind-numbing stuff. You know, we talk about the crazy stuff, you know, the New Testament and the Gospel and the Bible talks about. This is mind-numbing. I mean, let's give three little mind-numbing truths here, okay? Mind-numbing truth number one, it talks about the creator of the universe is walking among the people in flesh. That's insane. I mean, that is just like, that's incredible. I mean, talking about something just wow. But it gets even more crazy than that because it says, marking amongst his people, even showing that who he is, they reject him. You know, it's like, wait, the one who made you, who loves you, cares for you, rejected. But then the one that's totally explosively insane is that one who has all power in his hands, who loves him, who made the world, who's come down for them, submits to their judgment of him, submits to their punishment, allows them to flog him and crucify him. And flogging is this word we threw out there. It sounds like funny. Oh, flogging. No, man. I mean, you know, I don't know if anyone saw The Passion. He understated it. He couldn't even show you it because we can't handle even seeing what a flogging is. You know, we can't even, the concept that, you know, I mean, you guys know me, it's like a whip with pieces of bone and rocks going into the thing and just and collecting out flesh until the bone is exposed practically on the back. I'm sorry to say this, but this is what it is. That is what, I mean, it's, we need to somehow, there's sometimes horrible things we need to actually know. Okay? He submitted to that. That's mind-blowing. And what for? For us. This is God's great plan of redemption. They'd be like a Passover lamb whose blood is put up on the doors, slaughtered so we can be redeemed and die in our place. That's radical. That's crazy stuff. So what's it trying to do for us? What's he trying to tell us? I think one of the things we need to understand is just as they're on trial, just as those men are on trial. So, I mean, all of us, you know, are on trial. Often think, well, we're judging God or something. Is he going to be this, or we're going to judge whether he's a Messiah or not? It's like, who are you kidding? You know what? How much power you have by what you believe? Absolutely zilch. It's utterly irrelevant. You can believe anything you want. It affects nothing. What God believes about you is everything. You know, to what you believe is important to the extent that it affects what he believes about us. He's the one we stand before. He's the judge. And with a radical thing the Bible would say is that actually all of us reject him and fall away. Now, that's hard to accept. Now, did you see the weird thing that happens in the middle of these two trials? What happens in the middle of two trials when I read it? Anyone notice it? Hit the next one. It even talks about in the middle of it. You know, it took high priest, then it talks about Peter following at distance right into the courtyard, and the whole thing that's happening to Peter. One thing the writer's doing here by splashing a little bit right here, Peter's following at distance right in the courtyard. He sat with the fire. Then it goes back to the Sanhedrin, they're rejecting, then back to Peter and his denial before the rooster. What that's doing writing-wise is it's trying to make you see it's happening at the same time. do you see the effect he's giving? Where as Jesus is standing before the Sanhedrin, saying, I am the Messiah, and they're going, they're hitting him, they're slapping, they're blindfolding. There's Peter denying him. I don't know who he is. And finally saying, calling down curses down on himself. I don't know the guy. Peter, right? Peter's the one who made the great confession, right? Peter's the one who they said, who am I, Peter? You're the Messiah, Son of the living God. And Jesus says, listen, our Father in heaven revealed that to you. This is Peter who saw him walk on water. Peter who, stood by his side. Peter who said, even if all fall away, I will not fall away. So it's sort of like the extreme. Everywhere from up there at the Sanhedrin thing, all the way down to the one, the most faithful disciple. He goes, no, I don't even know the guy. What is he saying when he's calling down curses on himself? One can just imagine what that could possibly mean. What the writer's trying to show you is that even while it's almost like you can imagine the movie scene. They're doing all these things to him, and Peter, his most faithful follower, denying him, falling away. Fulfilling what Jesus said. Peter said that. Keep going. Yeah. You will all fall away, Jesus told them. For it's written, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered. That's a hard thing for us to realize, that we'll all fall away. Many of us think that if we're there, we're not like those Sanhedrin, we're not like Pilate, we're not the rejectors. But according to the scripture, it says we actually are all rejectors. We're all deniers. We're all like that. And what the incredible grace is did Jesus reject Peter now that he's rejected him? No. Peter was like all the rest that rejected and sent him to the cross. Pilate's indifference. But after the resurrection, he takes Peter and he lifts him back up again. He takes him, he forgives him. And that grace then transforms Peter. And Peter goes forth bringing that message of the good news, the redemption, the grace, the love of God, the forgiveness, and sends him out. And Peter spends the rest of his life telling the whole world about it. You think of Paul too, right? Paul, a rejector. Rejector turned around, forgiven, and goes forth there and speaks of God's grace. Do you struggle with seeing yourself in the role of the rejector? It's hard. Some of us, I think it's easier for, I was a complete rotten, blasphemer before I came to the Lord. So I haven't struggled with that as much. When God cared about me, the concept that I was sheerly by grace and let that grace transform me has been, a huge part of who I am. But I know for a lot of people, like raised in the church or raised around believers, or some of the people are cursed with actually being kind of good people. I say good because good's just on a, very much on a curve. Okay, but for you can look down at all these other people who don't pass the curve as well as you do, and you think, I'm kind of a good person. So you kind of think, I'm not so bad. But unfortunately, unless you can see that you're really bad, you'll never really understand grace. You'll always sit in judgment of others. Grace won't be pouring out of you because you won't really understand it. We need to understand how horrible we are. It's a hard thing to grasp, because when you understand how horrible you are, you understand how great he is. You understand the answers on the extremes, that we are far worse than we ever dared imagine, but far more loved than we ever dared hope. Now you ask yourself, how do I know if I get it? How do I know if I really get it down to the core of my being, that I'm bad? I don't know. One test? What's your praise and thankfulness meter? Is it coming out of you? Are you in touch with how incredible God's grace is to you? Is it pouring out of your thing? Are you thinking, I am so grateful, so thankful for everything that's walking around? Maybe if not, maybe you're struggling with understanding that. Jesus tells a story, Luke tells a story in 7. Remember Simon the Pharisee had Jesus into his house? And then a woman, instead of had lived a sinful life, ran down and was pouring perfume and tears on his feet and wiping it with her hair. And Simon's going, what's going on? Who's this? And Jesus looks at him and goes, I came in the house and you didn't anoint my head. He didn't wash my feet. He did nothing, but this woman's been washing my feet with her hair. She's been pouring out, kissing my feet. You didn't kiss me. He goes, he who has forgiven much loves much. He who's forgiven loves little. I think there's many of us who, we should all be like, and the point of that story is we're all actually should be like that woman at his feet, knowing how forgiven we are and loved. You know, you guys maybe have heard of a talk of church history. You know, Charles Wesley, you know, John Wesley and Charles Wesley, the brothers. Charles Wesley was a great hymn writer, wrote incredible songs of praise of God, you know, and it was always personal. But the funny thing is, he grew up in this totally religious home. Like, even when he went off to, he considered himself a really, really religious person. They went off to Oxford. They began the Oxford Holy Club, and he was trying to be really diligent in his prayer and worship life and all this. Him and his brother go off as missionaries to Georgia to go preach to the heathen. He preached many sermons calling people to obey God and follow his ways. And as Charles Wesley would reflect back on all those years, he would say, I was nothing but a Pharisee. There was nothing in my heart. I was just, you know, big old legalist. There was nothing. And he kept running into people who seemed to really have this love for God. And he finally said, it all kind of came ahead one night, and he realized, like, there's nothing in my heart. It's nothing but my self-righteousness. And he actually, in part of his story, he sat down with this guy. He calls this this poor, ignorant mechanic. He sat down, because he was this really educated person. He knew nothing but Christ, but Messiah. Yet by knowing him, he knows and discerns all things. And he sat down with this poor mechanic who sat to share with him about the love of God. And this man who'd been a preacher, a missionary, all that kind of stuff. And he says, it was that night where I fell on my knees and I realized I finally really gave myself to him and realized I needed his forgiveness. And he says that grace of God exploded into his heart that night. You know something? And that's when he suddenly became this incredible hymn writer. It was a year to the day after that where he wrote the famous song, Oh for a Thousand Tongues to Sing. And a lot of people think Oh for a Thousand Tongues talking about 1,000 languages. No, he's singing, Oh that I wish I had 1,000 tongues, that I could sing my great Redeemer's praise, the glories of my God and King, the triumphs of his grace. He breaks the power of canceled sin. He sets the prisoner free. His blood, meaning the life of Jesus, can make the foulest clean. His blood avails for me. Powerful stuff. You know, when we think about if we get it or not, take some heart from the story of Simon the Pharisee. It's pretty weird that we know Simon's name, isn't it? Think about all those other stories. You ever know a Pharisee's name? It's always just the Pharisees, right? But here's Simon the Pharisee. Why do we know Simon's name? In all likelihood, it means that Simon was a guy who walked around among the early believers. They knew Simon. Which means Simon eventually did get it, didn't he? And why is the reason we all know the story? It's because Simon probably used to tell that story again and again and again about how he stood up like there where the woman of ill repute got it and him, the righteous guy, didn't get it. But eventually he got it. And he probably used to tell this story so that people like you and me would get it too. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for the enormous grace, Lord. Help us to understand, Lord, and to realize that we're like Peter, Lord. We're like deniers, ones who fall away. That we are sinful. We're unfaithful. Yet, Lord, you are graceful, God, and you lift us up, and you forgive us, and you change us, Lord. I pray that each and every day and each and every moment your grace would just flow through our veins, that thankfulness would flow from our mouth, that we'd be vessels of grace to ourselves, in our marriages, in our families, and that we'd be telling of your goodness, Lord, to all people and all that you accomplish through your Messiah, our Passover Lamb. We praise you, Lord. In Yeshua's name we pray. Amen.